Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the Washington Post. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. We're going to begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler with Ted Gupp's When the Bomb Fell. This was published in the June 2020 issue of National Geographic. It's a different kind of travel piece, where today and yesterday intersect. As the editor's preface, more than seven decades after its devastation, Hiroshima has moved on. But for the remaining survivors, the horrors of a nuclear attack and the lessons of war remain vivid. We begin. 9 days after the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, after his parents and year-old brother died and his home was incinerated, seven-year-old Masaki Tanabe watched his father slip away. His last words, "I see no future as an army officer." An implacable enemy of America, Tanabe's father died with his sword at his side. Tanabe's grandfather wanted to keep his son's sword, but the occupation forces came and wrested it from him. Barbarians, young Tanabe thought. He was determined to take revenge against America, he says. Understandable. He had nothing and almost no one left. His home had been next to Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall, the now iconic building with the skeletal dome, preserved as an appeal for nuclear forbearance. Now in his early 80s, Tanabe is a handsome man, square-jawed and silver-browed. He is tradition personified in his gray genba robe with wide sleeves. He's also resourceful and adaptive. He became a filmmaker and studied computer graphics so he could construct a cyber version of the city that the bomb had erased. The result? Message from Hiroshima, a film that includes interviews with survivors of the August 6, 1945 bombing that, along with the atomic bombing of Nagasaki 3 days later, would kill up to 200,000 people, force Japan's surrender in World War II, and render unnecessary an Allied invasion of Japan that could have killed millions. Tanabe couldn't have predicted the wrenching changes that awaited him in Japan. His daughter married an American and settled in the United States. Tanabe long wrestled with the idea that she had embraced the enemy. 2 or 3 years after the wedding, Tanabe discovered a letter his daughter had left at the base of a stone Buddha in Yamaguchi Prefecture, where her grandfather, Tanabe's father, had died. In it, she told her grandfather she was sorry if she had disappointed him. As the years passed, Tanabe, like much of his generation, reconciled himself to a changed world. 75 years after the war's end, Tanabe's story is the story of Hiroshima and of Japan itself, a mix of tradition and modernity, of a determination never to forget, but also commitment not to be defined solely by the past. And as with Tanabe, events, personal and public, have yoked the two former enemies, Japan and America, to a shared future. Each August 6, the city pays homage to its 135,000-plus A-bomb victims, adding more names to a cenotaph. All other days of the year, its focus is decidedly forward. Today, Hiroshima has a near-messianic zeal as the world's champion of denuclearization, but it's also a vibrant hub for recreation, research, and commerce. After the bomb fell, Hiroshima was full of miraculous accounts of services restored, water, electricity, streetcars, and of unheralded heroes from near and far who helped bring the city back to life in the years afterward. Nanao Kamada grew up in the countryside nearly 400 miles from Hiroshima. Until 1955, when he was applying to medical school at the city, he hadn't thought much about the atomic bomb. But in Hiroshima, he saw people wearing caps and long sleeves in searing heat to conceal their burns. He would become an authority on treating A-bomb survivors and on radiation research. Today, Hiroshima's problems are those of many Japanese cities: a declining birth rate, an aging population, inadequate hotel capacity for its more than 2 million yearly visitors, and aging buildings and infrastructure. But there's a sense of urgency about preserving the memories of the survivors, the Hibakusha. There are about 47,000 of them in Hiroshima. Their average age, 82. The city has dispatched Hibakusha around the world, in person and via the Internet, to tell their stories. The Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum has a video library of more than 1,500 survivors' tales, some 400 viewable online. Some survivors are even available for video conferencing. Many say that sharing their stories gives more meaning to what they endured. For some survivors, the unfounded fears of other Japanese citizens became more of a burden than the after effects of radiation. Shosho Kawamoto was 11 when the bomb fell. He lost his mother, two sisters, and a brother. His surviving sister died of leukemia at 17. Though orphaned, he was fortunate. Rikiso Kawanaka, the owner of a soy sauce business in Tomo, a village some 7 miles from Hiroshima, took him in. Kawanaka fed and clothed Kawamoto. He also made him an unusual offer. If the boy agreed to work for 12 years without a salary, Kawanaka would give him a house. Years passed. Kawamoto rose at 2 a.m. and worked until 4 p.m, all without pay. When Kawamoto turned 20, he met a woman named Motoko. She was pretty and easy to talk to. She was learning to make dresses and kimonos. They fell in love. When Kawamoto turned 23, Kawanaka made good on his pledge. He gave Kawamoto the promised house. With his own home, Kawamoto felt ready to ask Motoko's father for permission to marry his daughter, but the father knew Kawamoto was from Hiroshima. He told him that any children the marriage might produce would be deformed from radiation. Actually, no health effects had been found in children of Hiroshima survivors. He forbade the union. Kawamoto was shattered. 2 days later, with marriage denied him, as it had been for many in Hibakusha, he quit his job, walked away from the house from which he had sacrificed so much, and left his village. He never saw Motoko again, and never again allowed himself to love, fearing more heartache. His life spiraled downward. He says he gambled and fell in with gangsters, Yakuza. He considered suicide. Eventually, he found work in a noodle shop, his opportunities limited by his sixth-grade education and his status as a Hibakusha, a modern-day leper to some. At 70, he returned to Hiroshima and there finally found some peace. Now 86, he's a grandfatherly figure in a straw hat and cotton vest, seen reaching into a shopping bag and pulling out origami planes and cranes. He gives them to children who visit the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. "Pull the tail," he says, beaming, "and see the wings flap." Printed on the plane's wings are the words, "Hope for Peace." There is no undoing the discrimination Kawamoto and other survivors suffered, but at Hiroshima University's Research Institute for Radiation Biology and Medicine, Director Satoshi Tashiro is determined to try to avoid such future discrimination. The Institute aims to improve communication between the media and scientists so that the public is not swayed by unwarranted fears. What happened to the Hibakusha, he says, also happens to those who live near Russia's Chernobyl nuclear plant and Japan's failed Fukushima reactor. The Funanari Matsuyama Nursing Home houses some 100 bomb survivors. The youngest, now 74, was in utero at the time of the blast. The oldest is Shiru Aminanori. She's 103. When the bomb went off, she was less than a mile from ground zero, giving her bedridden parents medicine. She suffered burns on her face, hand, and leg. Today, she is cheerful and prides herself on bounding up the nursing home stairs. She's a favorite of the staff. These survivors' care falls to the Atomic Bomb Survivors Support Division, which has a staff of 32 led by Takeshi Yahata, a son of Hibakusha. His grandfather disposed of corpses after the bombing. Now Yahata's division helps living survivors, with health care, social services, counseling, and nursing home and funeral expenses. Even now, telling Hiroshima's story can be contentious. A new exhibit at the Peace Memorial Museum took 16 years to complete, partly because of disputes among the exhibition committee, says Suichi Kato, the museum's deputy director. Some members wanted stark pictures of the horrors of nuclear war. Others argued for more restraint, afraid of traumatizing visitors. During a recent visit, I saw two people collapse. One debate was over what photo should greet visitors to the museum. It was resolved after Tetsunobu Fuji, the son of a survivor, saw a website photo of a young girl, her hand bandaged, her face bloodied and bruised. He believed it was his mother, Yukiko Fuji. The museum confirmed it was her at age 10. The committee unanimously chose the photo for the exhibit's entrance. Her photo at age 20 is at the exit. She would die at 42. They are iconic images, impossible to forget. For many who survived the blast, survivors' guilt and psychological scars endured. Emiko Okada, 82, wears a crane medallion around her neck, symbolizing hope and peace. She was 8 when the bomb fell. The morning her 12-year-old sister, Maiko Nakasako, announced she was going out. She was headed to within a half mile of Ground Zero. I asked Okada whether her sister died in the blast. "My elder sister is missing," she says. "Missing," I repeat, wondering what that means after 75 years. She has not returned home yet. There is something eerie about the word yet, as if Okada half expects Nakasako to suddenly appear at the door. That lack of resolution haunts Okada. Okada was not orphaned, but she may as well have been. Her parents desperately searched for their oldest daughter, abandoning Okada, who found herself living on the street, sleeping in an air raid shelter, eating what she could find on her steel, a discarded tomato, a fallen fig. Only later did her grandmother take her in. "My parents lost their minds after the loss of their daughter," Okada says. When her mother was cremated, she adds, pieces of glass that had flown like projectiles that August day reappeared among her ashes and bone fragments. For Okada and others, the horrors replay themselves even today. Okada hates evening glows like the sunset when the sky is orange or when the sky is really red because that reminds me of the night of August 6, she says. In Hiroshima, the young come to terms with the city's past in their own ways. Kanade Nakahara, 18, studied the bombing in school. In March 2019, went up to Pearl Harbor on a field trip. She's determined to work for peace. Others can't relate to that distant period near the Bank of Japan, which survived the blast but was where 42 people were killed. I find 17-year-old Kenta, an avid computer gamer. He regards that day as ancient history and isn't sure what year the bomb fell. He guesses 1964. On the other hand, Haruna Kikuno, 18, shudders at the sound of passing planes, the result, she says, of reading books about the bomb as a child. On the flight from Hiroshima to Tokyo, I introduced myself to the Hayama family. Theirs, too, is the story of Hiroshima and its implausible history. The father, 44-year-old Akihiro Yahama, Aki, grew up in Hiroshima, in a family of prominent political figures. His grandfather, Sodeshiru Hayama, is honored with a statue for his contributions to Hiroshima's rebirth. Hayama's maternal grandmother, Kiko Ochia, told him that a friend of hers had planned to travel the day Hiroshima was bombed, but fell ill. Rather than see her train ticket go to waste, she gave it to Ochia. Soon after the train departed, Ochia looked out the window and saw the mushroom cloud. Her friend did not survive. Today, Ochia is 91. She married and had a daughter and grandchildren. Grandson Hayama now lives in the United States in Norfolk, Virginia. There, in 2005, he met Leah Scheimer. They married and have two children, son Kai, 7, and daughter Emi, 5, who hugs her stuffed unicorn. During the war, Scheimer's grandfather, Sterling Arthur Scheimer, helped design the engines of the B-29 Super Fortress bombers. It was B-29s that rained tens of thousands of tons of explosives down on Japan, as well as incendiary bombs, and ultimately, the atomic bomb that decimated Hiroshima. Between flights, Hayama, Scheimer, and I speak of those war years. Kai listens, trying to make sense of it all. "Mama," he asks, "what's a mushroom cloud?" It falls to Scheimer to answer. "Dust and debris went up in the sky when the bomb went off," she tells him. "It was something really sad. A lot of people died," she adds. "They are sweet, innocent ears," she says later. "I am glad I can be the one to introduce some of this to him. But Kai has one more question. Are America and Japan still enemies?" "No," his mother says. "They are friends." And with that, the family heads for its gate and the long flight home. By the way, Ted Gupp is a former reporter for the Washington Post and Time magazine. He first wrote about Hiroshima's recovery in the August 1995 issue of National Geographic. And we are certainly pleased to be able to present the update for you. Quite an interesting story, to say the least. Well, war isn't the only legacy that many communities can share. There's also the challenge of simply getting around safely. Now, that's the theme behind Elizabeth Chang's story. She'd always dreamed of riding a scooter around Bermuda. Then she tried it. Her story, published in the January 3, 2020 issue of the Washington Post. And we begin. Every paradise on Earth has a dirty little secret. Mosquitoes, perhaps, or overcrowding, or jellyfish. Even the Garden of Eden had a snake. On a recent trip to Bermuda, a tiny territory rich in natural beauty, historic locales, and multi-hued charm, my husband and I ran smack into a hidden flaw. Its roads are unsettlingly dangerous. According to a 2011 government health report, Bermuda's traffic fatality rate was 28 per 100,000. The U.S. rate was 10. Though often referred to as an island, fishhook-shaped Bermuda is actually an archipelago of 138 islands measuring about 22 miles long and 1 mile wide. The 8 largest islands are connected by bridges and a causeway. There are 3 main roads, all of which, we would learn, are narrow, winding, and invariably shoulderless, if not rimmed with vegetation or walls. That, along with speeding and drinking, is the reason that in 2014 Bermuda had one of the highest traffic mortality rates among the 42 countries and partner nations in the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation. In 2018, 1,740 people were transported to the hospital with road injuries, according to the Bermuda Hospitals Board. There were 12 deaths. Newly instituted sobriety stops helped reduce the number of traffic deaths in Bermuda to 7 in 2019, though the number of hospital visits through October, the latest month available, was slightly up over the previous year. Of course, tourists can hardly avoid the roads. Most visitors arrive by cruise ship, as we did, and most cruise ships tie up at the Royal Naval Dockyard, a historical site and tourist attraction at the western tip of the island, far from the best beaches in any town. Because there is already too much traffic on the island, there are no rental cars, even households are limited to one automobile apiece, which means there are many motorcycles zooming around. To get anywhere, tourists must rely on scooters, public transit, buses and ferries, pricey taxes, or, the most recent option, electric cars. We would wind up testing all of these alternatives in a visit that revolved around transportation much more than we had expected. She begins next with the Scooter Chronicles. For decades, I had the idyllic dream that if we ever got to Bermuda, we'd tour it by scooter, breezing past pastel colleges to iconic pink sand beaches, wind whipping our hair, stopping for anything interesting we saw along the way. But then I read a strong warning about scooters in our guidebook, which noted that on average there is one death every month on Bermuda's roads. And at a cruise ship presentation about Bermuda, the speaker, who had been delightfully frank about the island's shortcomings, "The food is too expensive, the souvenirs are made elsewhere," refused to discuss all scooters. In fact, refused to discuss them at all. "I'm not going to get into that," he said. Well, still dreams die hard. Daryl, my husband, had owned a motorcycle in his admittedly long-ago youth, and some fellow middle-aged cruise passengers had rented scooters before and were planning to do so again. So, after docking in early September, we examined a 2-seat vehicle, took a few turns around the practice track, and set off for Gibbs Hill Lighthouse, about 8.5 miles away. The rental from Oleander Cycles was $65 for 24 hours, plus a one-time $30 repair waiver. Now, rather than blowing in the breeze, our hair was covered by mandatory helmets, which I soon realized were about the only concession to scooter safety on the island. Much as I wanted to gaze at the colorful homes and the sparkling water, I could glimpse through the trees. Ooh, there's a little beach. I was loath to turn my head. The two-lane road was tight and curvy. The oncoming traffic seemed frighteningly close, and I could feel the vehicles behind us breathing down our necks like lions toying with their prey. The 35 kilometer speed limit, kilometers per hour speed limit, apparently was an inside joke. It's closer to 80 kilometers per hour, and that's about 50 miles per hour in our use, and this is in practice. And for some reason, every driver was honking at us. And I haven't even mentioned that we had to drive on the wrong side of the road. Looking over Darrell's shoulder, I kept a weather eye on the yellow line, occasionally shouting, "Left! Left! Left!" And then it began to rain. We missed the 117-foot-tall lighthouse entirely on the first pass. Gibbs Hill, built in 1844 by convicts, overseen by the British Royal Engineers, is the oldest cast-iron lighthouse in the world and boasts a huge Fresnel lens with a 1,000-watt bulb. The light can be seen 40 miles away by sea. Once our legs stopped shaking, we climbed the 185 steps to the top and appreciatively took in the view. Lush greenery, white roofs topping homes painted in bright jelly bean hues, and a sea that displayed so many shades of blue, inky blue, deep blue, aqua blue, that I ran out of adjectives. Far off the misty distance, we could see our docked ship. The ride back was less stressful or eventful. The rain-slicked roads had dried, but the traffic was just as unnerving, and our backs were beginning to ache. It wasn't relaxing, especially for Darrell, and it certainly didn't seem safe. We took a farewell photo with the scooter, broke out the bus and ferry schedules, and tried to recalibrate our romantic expectations, a bit embarrassed and bewildered that the other middle-aged scooter riders were willing to go out again. When I checked the State Department's database of U.S. citizen deaths overseas on our return, I found out that 13 Americans had died in motorcycle accidents in Bermuda between January of 2003 and June of 2019. Resorting to buses and taxis. The next day, rather than zipping off to a famed Horseshoe Bay beach on scooter, we trundled up to it in the standing-room-only bus. "Air-conditioned," Darrell said as we boarded. "This is the way to go, and if you don't mind some extra walking, adhering to a schedule, and making lots of stops, it is. Bermuda's buses, $5 a ride, unless if you buy a pass, are affordable and run every hour or so, or half hour or so. During the mostly 35-minute trip, we chatted with our fellow passengers, including a Harley owner from Texas who insisted he'd never ride a scooter in Bermuda because it's so dangerous. Well, this cheered Darrell even more. Horseshoe Bay Beach is arguably stunning, with aqua waters advancing and retreating on an arc of sugar-soft, blush-colored sand bookend by rocky cliffs. The sand gets its unusual pigmentation from tiny single-cell organisms that grow on the undersides of nearby coral edges. When the foraminifera die, their red shells wash into the shore and mix with the white sand, giving it a pink tinge. While we didn't consider the sand especially pink, it was softest and finest we'd ever felt. We staked out some empty beachfront away from the sizable crowd and swam a little, but we were mostly content to gaze, mesmerized, at the crystalline waves framed by limestone bluffs. It was only toward the end of our visit that we got curious about the visitors who kept disappearing behind the cliffs at the edge of the beach. Following them, we found a series of charming rock-sheltered coves. In the first one, which I later learned is called Baby Beach, for its gentle waves, we saw, appropriately, a Bermuda longtail nesting in the hollow of a rock, looking serenely back at us with bright, satisfied eyes. I could have stayed all day, like that bird. But there were other beaches to check out. We took a taxi from Horseshoe to Elbow Beach, about 3.5 miles, or 10 minutes, and it's $15 with tip. Regaling our friendly cabbie with our scooter horror story, he insisted that the drivers hadn't been honking at us, but had been tooting hello to people they knew. Turns out the Bermudians used their horns with the friendly abandon of a politician waving from a parade float. Well, Elbow Beach, a long expanse of pink sand facing still more cerulean waters, was much less crowded than Horseshoe Bay, but not as picturesque. It's the bridesmaid to Horseshoe's bride, and after a sojourn, we climbed back up the road and waited in the sun for another bus. In her next segment, Elizabeth Chang talks about being ferried around. Ferries, high-speed, tourist-crammed catamarans with indoor and rooftop seating are the fastest way to get to the capital of Hamilton or the historic town of St. George's from the dockyard. The trips take about 20 and 40 minutes, respectively. Taxi rides would be twice as long, buses even longer. The fare is the same as for the bus system and much cheaper than going by taxi, which would be approximately $50 one way to Hamilton and $75 one way to St. George's. We were grateful, therefore, that we could stop, or rather hop, a ferry to Hamilton for the last harbor night of the summer. The main street of the city, which is a kaleidoscopic jumble of vibrantly painted homes and buildings, was closed to traffic to accommodate food and craft stands. But the highlight to us was the thrilling performance of the Gambe dancers, who donned riotously colorful, elaborately tasseled costumes, painted masks, and tall feathered headdresses, and act out stories to the insistent beat of bass and snare drums, punctuated by shrill whistles. The folk tradition, which borrows from African, Native American, Caribbean, and British cultures, dates to the 18th century, before slavery was outlawed in Bermuda, and requires both artistry and athleticism. We were also delighted to find a stand selling malasadas, Portuguese donuts, which are a beloved treat in Darrell's home state of Hawaii, too. The next day, we boarded another ferry to St. George's, which is at the opposite end of the island from the dockyard. Bermuda's first settlement, established by the English in 1612, has narrow cobblestone streets bearing whimsical names, Featherbed Alley, Aunt Peggy's Lane, and staid British colonial-style stone buildings, many enlivened by island colors. We took a walking tour and visited the Bermudian Heritage Museum, where we chatted with its charming docent and the perfumery, perfume being one of the few truly made in Bermuda souvenirs. Then we made the 1.5-mile round-trip trudge to Tobacco Bay Beach, a clear turquoise lagoon protected by a ring of limestone rock formations, with a tiny packed sand, pink sand beach overlooked by a music-blasting bar concession stand. We were too hot and tired to deal with the crowds, noise, and the party vibe, and were ready to head back long before the ferry was scheduled to return. "Now, there is an electric option," she writes. "By our final day on the island, we still hadn't tasted one of its famous fish sandwiches or made it to several sites on our Bermuda bucket list, and our ship was leaving at 3 p.m. So we rented an electric car, the Renault Twizys, which have been on Bermuda's roads only since 2017. These are open-air vehicles, a bit reminiscent of Little Tyke's Cozy Coupe's current vehicle's rents, the Twizy for about $100 per day, plus a one-time $30 insurance charge. A couple of other agencies offer slightly larger, more expensive electric vehicles with side-by-side seating. Though they drive like golf carts and aren't especially powerful, the Twizy's car-like controls and four wheels make them much safer to operate. Since operations commenced, we've had a handful of minor collisions in which there have been no significant injuries," says Somers Carr, who manages the Hamilton location of current vehicles. "The biggest drawback is the narrow tandem seating, which can be excruciating for a tall or older back passenger. Tooling around in the embarrassingly cute little car, though, was both relaxing and fun. We found the appropriately named Sea Glass Beach, tucked behind some derelict apartment buildings, and beheld layers upon layers of sea glass that tinkled like wind chimes as the waves washed in and out to conclude our final day." quite a trip there, huh? So keep the safety reminders. If you're thinking about Bermuda, keep those safety reminders in mind. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode. Be sure to listen next time. Hope you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.